19. Isolated. Allies. Eagle's wing. Petronella sat at her escritoire, filling page after page with her cramped handwriting, the spidery script tight and intense. Her dark hair was unbound and fell about her shoulders in untidy ringlets. Her complexion had the sallow appearance of one who has not stepped outside her room for many months, let alone seen daylight. A pile of papers beside her was testament to the months she had spent in her luxurious cabin, though its luxury was a far cry from what it had been when she had first arrived on the Vengeful Spirit. The bed was unmade, and her clothes lay strewn where she had discarded them before bed. Her maidservant, Babeth, had done what she could to encourage her mistress to pause in her labours, but Petronella would have none of it. The words of the War Master's valediction had to be transcribed and interpreted in the most minute detail if she was to do his confession any justice. Even though his words had turned out not to be his last, she knew they deserved to be recorded, for she had tapped into the War Master's innermost thoughts. She had teased out information no one had contemplated before, secrets of the Primarchs that had not seen the light of day since the Great Crusade had begun, and truths that would rock the Imperium to its very core. That such things should perhaps remain buried had occurred to her only once in her lonely sojourn. But she was the Palatina Majoria of House Carpinus, and such questions had no meaning. Knowledge and truth were all that mattered, and it would be for future generations to judge whether she had acted correctly. She had a dim memory of speaking of these incredible truths to some poet or other in a dingy bar many months ago, while very drunk, but she had no idea what had passed between them. He had not tried to contact her afterwards, so she could only assume that he hadn't tried to seduce her, or that she hadn't in fact been seduced. It was immaterial. She had locked herself away since the beginning of the war with the technocracy, trawling every fragment of her mnemonic implants for the words and turns of phrase that the War Master had used. She was writing too much, she knew. But damn the word count, her tale was too important to be constrained by the bindings of a mere book. She would tell the tale for as long as it took in the telling. But there was something missing. As the weeks and months had passed, the gnawing sensation that something wasn't gelling grew from a suspicion to a certainty, and it had taken her until recently to realize what that was. Context. All she had were the War Master's words. There was no framework to hang them upon, and without that, everything was meaningless. Finally realizing what was amiss, she sought out Astarte's warriors at every opportunity, but hit her first real obstacle in this regard. No one was speaking to her. As soon as any of her subjects knew what Petronella wanted, or who she was, they would clam up and refuse to speak another word, excusing themselves from her presence with polite abruptness. Everywhere she had turned, she ran into walls of silence, and despite repeated entreaties to the office of the War Master to intervene, she was getting nowhere. Every one of her requests for an audience with the War Master was declined, and she soon began to despair of ever finding a means of telling her tale. Inspiration as to how to break this deadlock had come yesterday, after yet another afternoon of abject failure. As always, Maggard escorted her, clad in his golden battle armor and armed with his Curlian rapier and pistol. After the fighting on Davin, Maggard had made a speedy recovery, and Petronella had noticed a more cocksure swagger to his step. She also noticed that he was treated with more respect around the ship than she was. Of course, such a state of affairs was intolerable, despite the fact that it made his vigour as her concubine that much more forceful and pleasurable. And Astarte's warrior had nodded in respect as Petronella despondently travelled along the upper decks of the ship towards her stateroom. She had made to nod back before realizing that the Astartes had been paying his respects to Maggard, not her. A scroll upon the Astartes' shoulder guard bore a green crescent moon, marking him out as a veteran of the Darwin campaign, and thus no doubt aware of Maggard's fighting prowess. Indignation surged to the surface, but before Petronella said anything, an idea began to form, and she hurried back to the stateroom. Petronella had stood Maggard in the center of the room and said, "It's so obvious to me now. Shame on me for not thinking of this sooner." Maggard looked puzzled, and she moved closer to him, stroking her hand down his molded breastplate. He seemed uncomfortable with this, but she pressed on, knowing that he would do anything for her, in fear of reprisal should he refuse. It's because I am a woman, she said. I'm not part of their little club. She moved behind him and stood on her tiptoes, placing her hands on his shoulders. I'm not a warrior. I've never killed anyone. Well, not myself. And that's what they respect. Killing. You've killed men, haven't you, Maggard? He nodded curtly. Lots. Maggard nodded again, and she laughed. I'm sure they know that too. You can't speak to boast of your prowess, but I'm sure the Astartes know it. Even the ones that weren't on Darwin will be able to see that you're a killer. Maggard licked his lips, keeping his golden eyes averted from her. I want you to go amongst them, she ordered. Let them see you. Inveigle yourself into their daily rituals. Find out all you can about them, and each day we will use the Nemo quill to transcribe what you've discovered. You're mute, so they'll think you simple. Let them. They will be less guarded if they think they humour a dolt. She could see that Maggard was unhappy with this task, but his happiness was of no consequence to her, and she had sent him out the very next morning. She had spent the rest of the day writing, sending Babeth out for food and water when she realised she was hungry, and trying different stylistic approaches to the introduction of her manuscript. The door to her stateroom opened, and Petronella looked up from her work. The chronometer set into the escritoire told her that it was late afternoon, ship time. She swiveled in her chair to see Maggard enter her room and smiled, reaching over to pull her data slate close, and then lifting the Nemo quill from the Leith well. You spent time with the Astartes? She asked. Maggard nodded. Good, said Petronella, sitting the reactive nib on the slate and clearing her mind of her own thoughts. Tell me everything, she commanded, as the quill began to scratch out his thoughts. The War Master's sanctum was silent, save for the occasional hissing mechanical hum from the exo-armature of Regulus's body, and the rustle of fabric as Malachurst shifted position. Both stood behind the War Master, who sat in his chair at the end of the long table, his hands steepled before him, and his expression thunderous. "The Brotherhood should be carrion food by now," he said. "Why have the World Eaters not yet stormed the walls of the Iron Citadel?" Captain Khan, equerry to Angron himself, stood firm before the War Master's hostile stare, the dim light of the sanctum reflecting from the blue and white of his plate armor.
"My lord, its walls are designed to resist almost every weapon we have available. But I assure you, the fortress will be ours within days," said Khan.
"You mean mine," growled the War Master.
"Of course, Lord War Master," replied Khan.
"And tell my brother Angron to get up here. I haven't seen hide nor hair of him in months. I'll not have him sulking in some muddy trench avoiding me just because he can't deliver on his promises."
"If I may be so bold, my Primarch told you that this battle would take time," explained Khan. "The Citadel was built with the old technology, and needs siege experts like the Iron Warriors to break it open."
"And if I could contact Perturabo, I would have him here," said the War Master. Regulus spoke from behind the War Master. "The STC machines will be able to counter much of the Mechanicum's arsenal. If the Dark Age texts are correct, they will adapt and react to changing circumstances, creating ever more cunning means of defense."
"The Citadel may be able to adapt," said Captain Khan,
angrily gripping the haft of his axe,
"but it will not be able to stand before the fury of the 12th Legion. The sons of Angron will tear the beating heart from that fortress for you, War Master. Have no doubt of that."
"Fine words, Captain Khan," said Horus. "Now, storm that citadel for me. Kill everyone you find within." The World Eater bowed and turned on his heel, marching from the sanctum. Once the doors slid shut behind Khan, Horus said, "That ought to light a fire under Angron's backside. This war is taking too damn long. There is other business to be upon." Regulus and Malachurst came around from behind the War Master, the equerry taking a seat to ease his aching body. "We must have those STC machines," said Regulus.
"Yes, thank you, Adept. I had quite forgotten that," said Horus. "I know very well what those machines represent, even if the fools who control them do not."
"My order will compensate you handsomely for them, my lord," said Regulus. Horus smiled and said,
"At last we come to it, Adept."
"Come to what, my lord?"
"'Do not think me a simpleton, Regulus,' cautioned Horus. "'I know of the Mechanicum's quest for the ancient knowledge. "'Fully functional construct machines would be quite a prize, would they not?'
"'Beyond imagining,' admitted Regulus, "'to rediscover the thinking engines that drove humanity into the stars "'and allowed the colonization of the galaxy is a prize worth any price.'
"'Any price?' asked Horus.
"'These machines will allow us to achieve the unimaginable, "'to reach into the halo stars, and perhaps even other galaxies,' said Regulus. "'So, yes, any price is worth paying.'
"'Then you shall have them,' said Horus. Regulus seemed taken aback by such a monumentally grand offer, and said,
"'I thank you, War Master. You cannot imagine the boon you grant the Mechanicum.'
Horus stood and circled behind Regulus, staring unabashedly at the remnants of flesh that clung to his metallic components. Shimmering fields contained the adept's organs, and a brass musculature gave him a measure of mobility.
"'There is little of you that can still be called human, isn't there?' asked Horus. "'In that regard you are not so different from myself, or Malachurst.'
"'My lord,' replied Regulus, "'I aspire to the perfection of the machine state.' But would not presume to compare myself with the Astartes.
As well you should not, said Horus, continuing to pace around the sanctum. I will give you these construct machines, but as we have established, there will be a price.
Name it, my lord. The Mechanicum will pay it.
The Great Crusade is almost at an end, Regulus, but our efforts to secure the galaxy are only just beginning. Said Horus, leaning over the table and planting his hands on its black surface. I am poised to embark on the greatest endeavor imaginable, but I need allies, or all will come to naught. Can I count on you and the Mechanicum?
What is this great endeavor? Asked Regulus.
Horus waved his hand and came around the table to stand next to the adept of the Mechanicum once more, placing a reassuring hand on his brass armature.
No need to go into the details just now, he said. Just tell me that you and your brethren will support me when the time comes, and the construct machines are yours.
A whirring mechanical arm wrapped in gold mesh swung over the table and placed a polished machine cog gently on its surface.
As much of the Mechanicum as I command is yours, War Master,
promised Regulus,
and as much strength as I can muster from those I do not.
Horus smiled and said, Thank you, Adept. That's all I wanted to hear. On the sixth day of the 10th month of the war against the Oretian technocracy, the 63rd expedition was thrown into panic when a group of vessels translated in-system behind it, in perfect attack formation. Boas Comnenus attempted to turn his ships to face the new arrivals, but even as the maneuvers began, he knew it would be too late. Only when the mysterious ships reached, and then passed, optimal firing range, did those aboard the vengeful spirit understand that the vessels had no hostile intent. Relieved hails were sent from the War Master's flagship to be met with an amused voice that spoke with a cultured accent of old terror.
"'Horus, my brother,' said the voice, "'it seems I still have a thing or two to teach you.'
On the bridge of the vengeful spirit, Horus said, "'Fulgrim.' Despite the hardships of the war, Loken was excited at the prospect of meeting the warriors of the Emperor's children once again. He had spent as much time as his duties allowed in repairing his armor, though he knew it was still in a sorry state. He and the Mournival stood behind the War Master as he waited proudly on the upper transit dock of the Vengeful Spirit, ready to receive the Primarch of the 3rd Legion. Fulgrim had been one of the War Master's staunchest supporters since his elevation to War Master, easing the concerns of Angron, Perturabo, and Curza, when they raged against the honor done to Horus and not them. Fulgrim's voice had been the breath of calm that had stilled bellicose hearts and soothed ruffled pride. Without Fulgrim's wisdom, Loken knew that it was unlikely that the War Master would ever have been able to command the loyalty of the Legion so completely. He heard metallic scrapes from beyond the pressure door. Loken had seen Fulgrim once before at the great triumph on Ulanor,
and even though it had been from a distance as he had marched past with tens of thousands of other Astartes warriors, Loken's impression of the Primarch had never faded from his mind. It was such a palpable honour to stand once again in the presence of two such godlike beings as the Primarchs. The eagle-stamped pressure door slid open, and the Primarch of the Emperor's Children stepped onto the vengeful spirit. Loken's first impression was of the great golden eagle's wing that swept over Fulgrim's left shoulder. The Primarch's armour was brilliant purple, edged in bright gold and inlaid with the most exquisite carvings. Hooded bearers carried his long, scaled cloak, and trailing parchments hung from his shoulder guards. A high collar of deepest purple framed a face that was pale to the point of albinism, the eyes so dark as to be almost entirely pupil. The hint of a smile played around his lips, and his hair was a shimmering white. Loken had once called Hastur Sejanus a beautiful man, adored by all, but seeing the Primarch of the Emperor's Children up close for the first time, he knew that his paltry vocabulary was insufficient for the perfection he saw in Fulgrim. Fulgrim opened his arms, and the two Primarchs embraced like long-lost brothers. "It has been too long, Horus," said Fulgrim.
"It has, my brother, it has," agreed Horus.
"My heart sings to see you.
But why are you here?
You are prosecuting a campaign throughout the Purdus Anomaly. Is the region compliant already?"
"What worlds we found there are now compliant, yes,"
nodded Fulgrim, as four warriors stepped through the pressure door behind him. Loken smiled to see Saul Tarvitz, his patrician features, unable to contain his relish at being reunited with his brothers of the Sons of Horus. Lord Commander Eidolon came next, looking as unrepentantly viperous as Torgadon had described him. Lucius the swordsman came next, still with the same sardonic expression of superiority that he remembered, though his face was now heavily scarred. Behind him came a warrior Loken did not recognize, a sallow-skinned Astartes in the armor of an apothecary, with gaunt cheeks and a long mane of hair as white as that of his Primarch. Fulgrim turned from Horus and said,
"I believe you are already familiar with some of my brothers, Tarvitz, Lucius, and Lord Commander Eidolon, but I do not believe you have met my chief apothecary, Fabius."
"It is an honour to meet you, Lord Horus," said Fabius, bowing low.
Horus acknowledged the gesture of respect and said,
"Come now, Fulgrim, you know better than to try to stall me. What's so important that you turn up here unannounced and give half my crew heart attacks?"
The smile fell from Fulgrim's pale lips, and he said,
"There have been reports, Horus."
"Reports? What does that mean?"
"Reports that things are not as they should be," replied Fulgrim. "That you and your warriors should be called to account for the brutality of this campaign. Is Angron up to his usual tricks?"
"Angron is as he has always been."
"That bad?"
"No. I keep him on a short leash, and his equerry Khan seems to curb the worst of our brother's excesses."
"Then I have arrived just in time."
"I see," said Horus. "Are you here to relieve me, then?"
Fulgrim could keep a straight face no longer, and laughed, his dark eyes sparkling with mirth.
"Relieve you? No, my brother. I am here so that I can return and tell those fops and scribes on Terra that Horus fights war the way it is meant to be fought. Hard, fast, and cruel."
"War is cruelty. There is no use trying to reform it. The crueler it is, the sooner it is over,"
Fulgrim said.
"Indeed, my brother. Come, there is much for us to talk about, for these are strange times we live in. It seems our brother Magnus has once again done something to upset the Emperor, and the Wolf of Fenris has been unleashed to escort him back to Terra."
"Magnus?" asked Horus, suddenly serious.
"What has he done?"
"Let us talk of it in private," said Fulgrim. "Anyway, I have a feeling my subordinates would welcome the chance to reacquaint themselves with your, what do you call it, Mournival?"
"Yes," smiled Horus.
"Memories of murder, no doubt." Loken felt a chill travel down his spine as he recognized the smile on Horus's face, the same one he had worn right after he had blown out the Aurician consul's brains on the embarkation deck. With Horus and Fulgrim gone, Abaddon and Aximand, together with Eidolon, followed the two Primarchs, while Loken and Torgadon exchanged greetings with the Emperor's Children. The Sons of Horus welcomed their brothers with laughter and crushing bear hugs, the Emperor's Children with decorum and reserve. For Torgadon and Tarvitz, it was a reunion of comrades, with a mutual respect forged in the heat of battle, their easy friendship clear for all to see. The apothecary, Fabius, requested directions to the Medicae deck, and excused himself with a bow upon receiving them. Lucius remained with the two members of the Mournival, and Torgadon couldn't resist baiting him just a little.
"So, Lucius, you fancy another round in the training cages with Garviel? From the look of your face, you could do with the practice."
The swordsman had the good grace to smile, the many scars twisting on his flesh, and said,
"No, thank you. I fear I may have grown beyond Captain Loken's last lesson. I would not want to humble him this time."
"Come on, just one bout," asked Loken. "I promise I'll be gentle." "Yes, come on, Lucius," said Tarvitz. "The honour of the Emperor's children is at stake."
Lucius smiled.
"Very well, then."
Loken could not remember much of the bout. It had been over so quickly. Evidently, Lucius had indeed learned his lesson well. No sooner had the practice cage shut than the swordsman attacked. Loken had been ready for such a move, but even so was almost overwhelmed in the first seconds of the fight. The two warriors fought back and forth, Torgadon and Saul Tarvitz cheering from outside the practice cages. The bout had attracted quite a crowd, and Loken wished Torgadon had kept word of it to himself. Loken fought with all the skill he could muster, while Lucius sparred with a casual playfulness. Within moments, Loken's sword was stuck in the ceiling of the practice cage, and Lucius had a blade at his throat. The swordsman had barely broken sweat, and Loken knew that he was hopelessly outclassed by Lucius. To fight Lucius with life and death resting on the blades would be to die, and he suspected that there was no one in the Sons of Horus who could best him. Loken bowed before the swordsman and said,
"That's one each, Lucius."
"Care for a decider?"
smirked Lucius, dancing back and forth on the balls of his feet and slicing his swords through the air.
"Not this time," said Loken. "Next time we meet, we'll put something serious on the outcome, eh?"
"Any time, Loken," said Lucius. "But I'll win. You know that, don't you?"
"Your skill is great, Lucius. But just remember, there's someone out there who can beat you."
"Not in this lifetime," said Lucius.
The quiet order met once again in the armory, though this was a more select group than normally gathered, with Lodgemaster Sergar Targost presiding over an assemblage of the Legion's senior officers. Aximand felt a pang of regret and loss as he saw that, of the Legion's captains, only Loken, Torgadon, the Acton Cruz, and Tybalt Mar were absent. Candles lit the armory, and each captain had dispensed with his hooded robe. This was a gathering for debate, not theatrics.
"Brothers," said Targost, "this is a time for decisions, hard decisions. We face dissent from within, and now Fulgrim arrives out of the blue to spy on us."
"Spy," said Aximand. "Surely you don't think that Fulgrim would betray his brother? The Warmaster is closer to Fulgrim than he is to Sanguinius."
"What else would you call him?" asked Abaddon. "Fulgrim said as much when he arrived."
"Fulgrim is as frustrated by the situation back on Terra as we are," said Malachurst. "He knows that those who desire the outcome of war do not desire to see the blood of its waging. His legion seeks perfection in all things, especially war, and we have all seen how the Emperor's children fight, with unremitting ruthlessness and efficiency. They may fight differently from us, but they achieve the same result. When Fulgrim's warriors see how the war is fought on Aureus, they will know that there is no honour in it," added Luke Sedere. "The World Eaters shock even me. I make no secret of the fact that I live for battle and revel in my ability to kill. But the Sons of Angron are uncivilized. They do not fight, they butcher."
"They get the job done, Luke," said Abaddon. "That's all that matters. Once the Titans of the Mechanicum break open the walls of the Iron Citadel, you'll be glad to have them by your side when it comes time to storm the breaches."
Sedere nodded and said, "There is truth in that. The Warmaster wields them like a weapon. But will Fulgrim see that?"
"Leave Fulgrim to me, Luke," said a powerful voice from the shadows, and the warriors of the Quiet Order turned in surprise as a trio of figures emerged from the darkness.
The lead figure was armored in ceremonially adorned armor, the white plates shimmering in the candlelight, and the red eye on his chest plate glowing with reflected fire. Aximand and his fellow captains dropped to their knees as Horus entered their circle, his gaze sweeping around his assembled captains.
"So, this is where you've been gathering in secret.
"My lord," began Targost, but Horus held up his hand to silence him.
"Hush, Sirgar," said Horus. "There's no need for explanations. I have heard your deliberations and come to shed some light upon them, and to bring some new blood to your quiet order."
As he spoke, Horus gestured to the two figures that had accompanied him to come forward. Axeman saw that one was an Astartes, Tybalt Mar, while the other was a mortal, clad in gold armor, the warrior who had fought to protect the War Master's documentarist on Davin.
"Tybalt you already know," continued the War Master. "Since the terrible death of Verulam, he has struggled to come to terms with the loss. I believe he will find the support he needs within our order. The other is a mortal, and though not Astartes, he is a warrior of courage and strength."
Sirgar Targost raised his head and said,
"A mortal within the order? The order is for Astartes only."
"Is it, Sirgar? I was led to believe that this was a place where men were free to meet and converse, and confide outside the strictures of rank and martial order."
"The War Master is right," said Axeman, rising to his feet. "There is only one qualification a man needs to be a part of our quiet order. He must be a warrior."
Targost nodded, though he was clearly unhappy with the decision.
"Very well. Let them come forward and show the sign," he said.
Both Mar and the gold-armored warrior stepped forward and held out their hands. In each palm, a silver lodge medal glinted.
"Let them speak their names," said Targost.
"Tybalt Mar,"
said the captain of the 18th Company. The mortal said nothing, looking helplessly at Horus. The lodge members waited for him to announce himself, but no name was forthcoming.
"Why does he not identify himself?"
asked Axemand.
"He can't say," replied Horus with a smile.
"Sorry. I couldn't resist, Sirgar. This is Maggard, and he is mute. It has come to my attention that he wishes to learn more of our legion, and I thought this might be a way of showing him our true faces."
"He will be made welcome,"
assured Axemand.
"But you didn't come here just to bring us two new members, did you?"
"Always thinking, little Horus," laughed Horus. "I've always said you were the wise one."
"Then why are you here?"
asked Axemand.
"Axemand," hissed Targost. "This is the War Master. He goes where he wills."
Horus held up his hand and said,
"It's all right, Sirgar. Little Horus has a right to ask. I've kept out of your affairs for long enough, so it's only fair I explain this sudden visit."
Horus walked between them, smiling and bathing them in the force of his personality. He stood before Axemand, and the effect was intoxicating. Horus had always been a being of supreme majesty, whose beauty and charisma could bewitch even the most stoic hearts. As he met the War Master's gaze, Axemand saw that his power to seduce was beyond anything he had experienced before, and he felt shame that he had questioned this luminous being. What right did he have to ask anything of the War Master? Horus winked, and the spell was broken. The War Master moved into the center of the group and said,
"You are right to gather and debate the coming days, my sons, for they will be hard indeed. Times are upon us when we must make difficult decisions, and there will be those who will not understand why we do what we do, because they were not here beside us."
Horus stopped before each of the captains in turn, and Axemand could see the effect his words were having on them. Each warrior's face lit up as though the sun shone upon it.
"I am set upon a course that will affect every man under my command, and the burden of my decision is a heavy weight upon my shoulders, my sons."
"Share it with us," cried Abaddon. "We are ready to serve."
Horus smiled and said,
"I know you are, Ezekiel, and it gives me strength to know that I have warriors with me who are as steadfast and true as you."
"We are yours to command,"
promised Sirgar Targost.
"Our first loyalty is to you."
"I am proud of you all,"
said Horus, his voice emotional.
"But I have one last thing to ask of you."
"Ask us,"
said Abaddon. Horus placed his hand gratefully on Abaddon's shoulder guard and said,
"Before you answer, consider what I am about to say carefully. If you choose to follow me on this grand adventure, there will be no turning back once we have embarked upon it. For good or ill, we go forward, never back."
"You always were one for theatrics," noted Axemand.
"Are you going to get to the point?"
Horus nodded and said,
"Yes, of course, little Horus.
But you'll indulge my sense for the dramatic, I hope.
It wouldn't be you otherwise.
Agreed, said Horace. But yes, to get to the point, I am about to take us down the most dangerous path, and not all of us will survive. There will be those of the Imperium who will call us traitors and rebels for our actions. But you must ignore their bleatings, and trust that I am certain of our course. The days ahead will be hard and painful, but we must see them through to the end.
What would you have us do? Asked Abaddon.
In good time, Ezekiel, in good time, said Horus. I just need to know that you are with me, my sons. Are you with me?
We are with you,
shouted the warriors as one. Thank you, said Horus, gratefully. But before we act, we must set our own house in order. Hector Varvarus and this Remembrancer, Carcassi, they must be silenced while we gather our strength. They draw unwelcome attention to us, and that is unacceptable.
Varvarus is not a man to change his mind, my lord, warned Aximand,
and the Remembrancer is under Garvial's protection.
I will take care of Varvarus, said the Warmaster. And the Remembrancer, well, I'm sure that with the correct persuasion he will do the right thing.
What do you intend, my lord?
Asked Aximand.
That they be illuminated as to the error of their ways, said Horace.